Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of SLA, Second Language Acquisition for Everyone. Today's episode, we're focusing on co-creation of content in class and how it relates to student emotion and motivation. But before we start today, we got a very nice email from our last episode on class observations. So this email is from Liz, and she says, "Hello all, I just wanted to tell you how much I needed to hear this most recent episode about observations. I recently switched to CI, and even though I'm loving it, my admins have been pushing back during observations. They said they wanted more rigor, just as you mentioned, and that they wanted more output from the students, just as you said. It's like you all had seen my post-observation meeting before you recorded this episode. It was so reassuring to hear your thoughts and advice. Thanks to you all, I have a ton of resources and insights to help me with my next observation and the assurance that I'm not crazy and I'm on the right track with CI. God bless you all and keep doing what you're doing. You are making a big difference in this stressed out teacher's life, and I'm certain I'm only one of many." And that was from Liz.
Queen. If you're listening to this, Liz, again, you slay. We love it. Thank you so much for this kind email. It brought a smile to all of our faces.
Right, a little bit. Like, it brought a tear to my eye.
Yeah, I think it is easy to feel lonely in this job. I mean, you close the door, you teach, and it's just like, well, and then you get one observation, and someone comes and is like, why no rigor? And you're like, you don't understand, and it feels like you against the world. So you are not alone in this. That's part of why we make the podcast, is to continue these conversations all together, and we so appreciate the kind words.
Again, thank you, Liz, for such a nice email. All right, on to how we've gaslit ourselves about co-creating content with students. So I think probably the most common form of co-creation in class is probably story asking. Ben, Brian, have you had experience with story asking in your classes?
I have had it happen that I'm like, we're going to try to put together a little story now. And maybe I had little target structures that I was trying to do. I was like, I really want my kids to learn these verbs or function words, you know, together as structures and target them. And when I do the story, it's going to be amazing. They're going to acquire them. And then had my class devolve into an absolute chaotic heap of students arguing over each other in English about the specific details of the story, kind of leaving behind my targets so that instead of, you know, hitting them, we were wandering in the field next to them. And it felt very frustrating to feel like I'd lost complete control by like trying to open this door to creativity. Instead, it had opened the door to chaos, madness, and destruction.
Yeah, I've had experiences. Almost everyone probably that has switched to doing story asking from a different teaching method could tell you like their first experience. Probably they didn't anticipate, or maybe they did anticipate, but like were not experts at controlling how the class behaved, which kind of most likely affected the effectiveness of the actual activity. And yes, the chaos that you described, I know it very well. But now things are a lot better. But anyway, Bill?
Yeah, I think something that is a problem for students probably is that doing co-creation of content is probably a lot different than anything that they do in any of their other classes. So not only do we have to teach them language, but we also have to teach them how to kind of be responsible for their own learning and like doing what, like, if you want this story to be interesting, give me interesting ideas. Like, if you want, like, I'm giving you the power. I know where I'm going to go with the story. if you don't give me any information, but I would like you to be more involved. So a lot of other times, I think in classes, it might be a lot of lecture. I know that there's, just as there's advancements in language teaching, I'm positive there's been advancements in teaching other content areas as well. So I wonder if other teachers kind of have that issue of like, hey, I'm trying doing something completely new that does not look like school. Let's try to make it work. On that, like trying to teach students how to participate and be like an active or in their education. It, you know, keep trying to get students to give us ideas and not being able to decide on a scene, like not being able to decide on the character's name in a story. So I always end up going with something silly like Bobby Joe Boy. I don't know. Something that I can just riff. They always start with B's, I have noticed. Probably.
It's like our podcast.
We start with a bunch
of B's. It is the best letter.
I'm with you, but sometimes when you're given such open choice and the teacher's asking you to be creative, your brain runs wild. And so I'm with you that like one of my learnings from trying to co-create content with students is just sometimes you just have to be the decider in the interest of time to bring it back to the language. And that feels gross because you're like, I want to give choice to everybody and everyone's voice will be heard. But I think even ahead of time, telling students like sometimes someone's going to have to make a choice. And because my name's on your transcript, it'll be me. And so, yeah, it feels hard when you're like, I'm doing this to increase student autonomy. But sometimes you just like, if the kids are going to crazy town, sometimes you just have to choose. And that's okay.
Have you ever tried having like a teacher to, like, I don't know what it's called. And I mean, and I always say professeur de, but like, I don't know. Basically, I choose a student to be the decider. And so everyone in advance knows that this student is the decider and they come up at the front. And whenever we're having difficulty deciding something, I turn to them and they make the choice and there we go, you know? And so that way there is no arguments about it anymore, but also students don't feel like it's me just like making all decisions, even though sometimes I still do, I overrule them, but you know, I try to do that only when absolutely necessary. So.
Yeah. Something similarly, I use a flippity name randomizer. So like if we're at a stalemate, I'll just go over to the name wheel and just hit it. And whoever it lands on, you get the final say. So I think that's like a, you know, if you've got a way to like do a tiebreaker of sorts, I think that's a good thing to go into the day of story asking with. Similarly, hopefully you have a full script. And it not even as like, yeah, it's helpful to have the support of like, oh, where was I going? You can just take a look at the script. But also, oh, we're not making any progress and we're still defining who the character is. You can just move on if you already have something written out. If you've already gotten something and your story in class does stray from that, you can then have the reading right away to have something for students to see the same vocabulary in a different context or a similar context. But yeah, what other issues might people fall into when they're trying to co-create something with class? So like, we don't just have story asking, right? We've got one word images. I learned about one word scenes recently. It was at the Comprehension-Based Communicative Language Teaching Special Interest Group webinar last week. The presenter talked about one word scenes. If you're familiar with one word story, one word images, you start with one word, maybe, and usually it's some sort of inanimate object that through the power of co-creation comes alive and has a personality. The one word scene, however, is like, I really kind of wish I would have done it this week because it would have been great to do it with Halloween around and like, oh, let's describe what would be a scary scene. So like, give me the place that it takes place in, and then how do we make that creepy? Something like that. Or like, ooh, let's design a photo finish scene about blah, 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 horse racing. Oh, we see a horse with its nose right past the finish line. But there, the jockey on top of him has... Do you remember Little Rascals? Yes. When Alfalfa is doing like the race, and you can't see it, but I've got my finger on my head, like his hair, and he won by a hair. Famous line by Whoopi Goldberg.
Amazing.
But
I'm even thinking, now that you're saying this, I'm like, well, it would be kind of nice to, like, you could even add scenes to books you're reading.
That'd be cool. Same thing. So what other kind of issues might people run into?
I mean, what always happens to me is that my students make suggestions are not school appropriate. I mean, they're teenagers, they're testing boundaries, they're having hormonal issues, they are immersed in internet culture. Lots of reasons contribute to that, but that's just why I always have to make sure that before we start, I like really establish my expectations. And I'm like, what I actually started telling them this year is that, okay, we are eventually going to use this story to create like a book that will go in our library. So make sure it's something you'd be okay reading your younger brother in elementary school. If it's not, don't suggest it. And so it can still be like creative, but like, I'm like, okay, I'm sick of like them trying to sneak in, you know, slang and things that are just not good for them.
It's a peach. It's a blur, blah, blur. And you're like, I was not born yesterday, child. I'm with you. Yeah, the inappropriate suggestions. I'm always like, hey, if I called your parent right now and asked them about that thing you were just saying, would they be pleased that I was calling to ask you about that thing? Would they be able to explain it in a way that is not embarrassing or problematic for you? And sometimes that helps a little bit too. So, but play a little bit dumb. I think the inappropriate suggestions is for real. I think one element of it is that because a lot of these activities are true interpersonal communication, where you ask a question and you actually don't know the answer ahead of time. You don't know what's coming next. You're not just teaching information that is set already. There's a certain element of chance that everyone that day showed up ready to talk about this, that everyone that day is in a mood, that nothing happened in their personal lives or in the school life that is going to prevent them from wanting to participate in this way. It is very unpredictable because ultimately you're managing the brain energies of 30 plus humans and then yourself and trying to keep that all together while creating some sort of cohesive something. And so it is very unpredictable what the kids are going to bring to the table. And that can be distressing. I enjoy making my plans and having certainty. But then it also plays into your expectations of what this sort of activity, in quotation marks, does. Like, what do you accomplish at the end of a session of story asking? Like, what do you accomplish at the end of a one-word image? Or even at the end of something like, I would argue that weekend chats are in a certain element co-creative, or like card talk. Many of the activities that generate input, that element of interpersonality where you're asking a question, you don't know the answer. Once you do that, what does it do? Do we expect students to have mastered specific words and phrases perfectly and then be able to reproduce them in speech and writing immediately? Do we expect them to hear them one time and know them forever? Do we think that, you know, like this is just an activity that you do as like a fun aside and then you go back to doing whatever else you're doing? Because I think you're going to get I hope maybe it's clear that like the examples that I've just given are situations where you won't necessarily have a lot of success getting those things that you want. What you're doing is something else. It's, you know, a long-term game towards acquisition that you have to support and supplement with other activities, with other reuses and recyclings of the new language, and that you have to, you know, have faith that the acquisition process is going to play out over time. So if you do one of these activities to be like, to try to teach an AR verb, you might have a hard time because that's not exactly how language is acquired. So disappointment can come from going in without a plan and then being run over by the creative and sometimes, you know, inappropriate skewing minds of our young people, but then also having these expectations that these activities do a certain thing when they do something else, perhaps.
I've got a comment, a question, and then a reflective question for listeners. So my comment is that I don't know if I've mentioned this before on the podcast or not, but something that I think about a lot is like can-do statements. Like what's your can-do statement for story asking? I found, for me personally, that is like not an effective way to get students interested in why we're doing what we're doing. So I try to lead with like, why are we doing this? Why are we going to take this day to make up something that's maybe not real world, but could be fun and entertaining and done in the language? Instead of doing can-do statements, I try to do purpose statements, like why are we doing this? And so a lot of times with story asking or co-creating something, the purpose is we're building vocabulary. I'm trying to give you the vocabulary that you need in a way that is going to be easily digestible. And I can be like, oh yeah, remember when we were talking about, like this even happened today, not with story asking, but my password this week was aunque el mono se viste de seda, mono se queda. Although the monkey wears silk, it's still a monkey. And today in class, students needed to use the word seda, silk. And they're like, oh, like I know I've seen that word. I'm like, well, yeah, because I've been building your vocabulary throughout the year with passwords. Remember that time that we used this other word? We can use that word now too. So, which I know is like part, like is in context versus not in context aside. So my question, and maybe both of these are reflective questions because we need to move along, but what to do when story asking becomes more of storytelling, or you're doing more telling than asking, because we know that questions are important. Go back and listen to episode 2. And my reflective question would be to like, how much new vocabulary or low frequency vocabulary are you willing to include in a story? Is it worth the mental effort to teach the word for ostrich today?
Yes, always.
But so that's just some things to think about, is like, you know, what to do when we're telling more than asking, and vocabulary choice for stories. We don't have to answer that now if we need to move along.
Into telling my students, like, you get one word, because sometimes we are taking their ideas for the story in English, and that's fine for me because we can quickly get it back to the language if we're having a decision-making process, like, you know, a profe dos, or like a, or just being deciding ourselves, or wheel, you know, flippity wheel decide. But sometimes I just say it has to be just one word. Or especially right at the end of the story when we're trying to wrap it all up, I'm like, wrap this up in one sentence, because otherwise kids will just go. And so one way to limit that is just by putting limits on the English input, right? And I think those words are so interesting that they might get acquired much more quickly, right? Because there is that high interest. Like, yeah, I want to learn how to say ostrich in German. Like, that's cool. So
I said caca once and it was acquired.
Over. Game over. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Certain words are just loaded like that and they get acquired more easily. Whereas like we can't get, you know, kids to remember the word for in, even though like in German it's literally just in, or in Spanish it's like en. But, you know, that's just the way that it is. It is loaded with emotion and interest, and so those get acquired more easily. But I think setting limits is one way to kind of prevent that new vocabulary overload and keep things moving.
Brian, any thoughts before we move on to unlocking that gate to research?
My thoughts mostly pertain to girl bossing, so I think we can go ahead and move on. So yes, so today we were talking about a study that was carried out in 2021. Dr. Liam Printer, who also has his own podcast, The Motivated Classroom, which I highly recommend that you listen to and check out when you have the time.
Huge fan.
And it is about positive emotions and intrinsic motivation and their connection to co-creative stories in the language acquisition classroom. So the study set out to investigate how using a TPRS, teaching proficiency through reading and storytelling, affects students' motivation and emotions through the lens of the self-determination theory, which basically asks the questions of, do students feel competent? Do they feel autonomous? And do they see connections between what they're doing in their own lives? So the idea of relatedness. And so basically, how does, you know, TPRS affect those things? So this took place in an international school in Switzerland, where there was a smaller class, I think, of 10 students studying French who had different backgrounds in terms of home languages. And it seemed that there was a variety of ability levels, but there was a commonality that many of the students had previously taken French, but they didn't pass it. And so they were retaking it that year with the teacher. The students also had some negative experiences with TPRS in the past with a previous teacher who did not really receive much training or support in the strategies involved there. So they kind of had a negative outlook on TPRS. They kind of felt like it was repetitive because, you know, maybe the teacher was just kind of repeating the same sentences and vocabulary over and over again without really getting much student input or without doing much interaction with the students. So they just thought it was boring. And at the start, the teacher involved in the study expressed feeling kind of pressed about going to class because she wasn't feeling successful. She didn't necessarily feel confident in using TPRS, but then she went to a training, learned more about using the strategies, and decided to do a TPRS activity over the course of 10 school days. They go through the different steps of the recommended steps of a TPRS lesson, which starts out with showing the meaning of different words, often using gestures. Maybe they have 3 or 4 target structures that they want to focus on, ensuring that students understand those. And then we've got the telling part where the story develops through the input of the students. So it is also really important to mention that when you do TPRS and story asking, you are asking, not telling. In this case, we want to ask and not tell. want to make sure that students feel like they are, if they're not in the driver's seat, they're at least in the passenger seat telling the driver where to go. And so after that, they create some kind of text related to the story that they came up with and read it and do activities related to that. There were 4 stages of the study that both students and the teacher filled out about things related to motivation and positive and negative emotions, as well as focus group interviews that were conducted with groups of students and more one-on-one interviews with the teacher. Those happened in October, November, February, and June throughout the school year. So we got to see kind of the progress from the beginning of the year when they were not really used to TPRS and towards the end and how they felt about it eventually at the end. Overall, very positive results. Students felt a lot more motivated, they felt a lot more connected to each other, and they felt that they were learning while having fun, which is always what we want. The teacher also expressed more enjoyment of actually coming to class and more successful with the students. One quote is that the student said that the teacher would make sure that everyone knew what was happening. So while telling the story, establishing meaning, and making sure that nobody is left behind confused, they said that she explained it in other ways and helped everyone understand almost everything. And to feeling connected to each other, a student remarked that everyone was able to chip in their ideas, and that way it was based on their own interests and they could relate to it. They found it more engaging. So at the end of the year, the students said that they attributed their desire to learn French to the classroom environment and the sense of belonging that was in part by this teacher deciding to use TPRS. The study also mentions the importance of training and support for TPRS. As mentioned earlier, the students had a negative experience with the teacher who was inexperienced using and needed more support. The students themselves perceived a chaotic environment when the class was not controlled very well, negatively affected their motivation and their emotions. Having good classroom management and clear expectations is extremely important for the success of doing this, as well as giving quieter students the opportunity to participate. If you have it free-flowing and you don't have strong, clear expectations, the more extroverted students tend to be the ones who make contributions and the quieter ones may not. Think about ways that you can make sure that everyone's voice is heard. So because this was a case study of 10 students, it is limited to that context of that school. But if you teach in a similar environment, you might find that things are similar for you, or you may find something that you can take and adapt to your own context. So yeah, that's pretty much what happened in this study. Any thoughts on that?
One thing that really stuck out to me the first time I was reading it that I underlined is that, and maybe I can find the actual specific quotation, is just that, like, one of the greatest sources of anxieties for students is the techniques of the teacher. And that, I don't know why the phrasing that way just kind of stuck out to me. Let me find this real quick. Teachers' pedagogical practices are routinely reported as the main sources of both anxiety and enjoyment in the FL classroom. For some reason, that stuck out to me as just like, dang, like the things that we choose can either provoke intense anxiety, which makes kids not want to do the class, not want to be part of the class, and shut down their willingness to learn. If we're thinking about the affective filter hypothesis, it might actually inhibit their acquisition of the language that we're trying to, you know, jam into their brains through force of will. Then, like, bummer, huge bummer. That, and so I think it is important to reflect and, you know, and ask. And I also want to rewind to a couple of minutes ago where Brian made an excellent don't ask, don't tell joke. And because we are politely muted, Bill and I were both losing it. And so we just need the listeners to know that we found that very funny, but you just wouldn't hear it in the recording. Anyways, yeah, so back to business. I think the study pointing that out, that this teacher chose a technique that brought a lot of enjoyment to the class, is a choice that we as practitioners can make. We can choose the joyful techniques. We can choose the path of pleasure. I think maybe it's Krashen that said too, like, the path of pleasure is the only path. Like, that's the only way to really acquire the language, is finding your joy in that. And if, you know, using TPRS like this for this teacher increased the joy for them and their students, who again had bad feelings about language classes in general, but also specifically about TPRS because of a previous experience they had, then, like, you know, it just takes the training, it takes the support, it takes choosing the path of pleasure, and then we can get a lot out of that and kind of increase the chances that our kids are going to stick with the language. If they're motivated like that, they'll stick with it. I think the other point that stuck out to me is, like, that if you have motivated students, you have motivated teachers. Like, if you're doing stuff that is enjoyable, it's enjoyable for you too, which is motivating for you. If you're connecting the students to each other, you're not, you know, a piece of furniture in the classroom. You are often making connections to the students as well. High target language use environments make everyone feel competent. The language teacher, it makes them feel like a language teacher. And the students, it makes them like, oh, I'm in a language class and, like, I'm understanding. So, like, great. So they're getting that. And then having the choice and the elements of surprise adds to that feeling of autonomy, which is important in self-determination theory. If I remember correctly, Dr. Printer talked about how of the three, the autonomy is actually one of the most powerful motivators, is like having choice in what you learn and how you learn it. And so if we can get motivated students through using different techniques, trying things out and improving our skills in those, we're going to end up more motivated ourselves, because we're going to feel good, like we're good at our jobs and we're going to be connected to our students. And we made the choice to do something that's good for them. And so that feels very exciting. You know, it is a path forward. It's exciting to read this and know that the choices that we can make pedagogically can lead to more joy for our students and then also for us, and make our own jobs more fulfilling. This is exciting and very motivating for me to, I don't know, keep learning and try to do better in things that really, really work.
Yeah, and something that I would just want to add or, like, comment on is about going back to the, yeah, some of these kids had experiences with TPRS, but it wasn't a positive experience. And, like, just a word of encouragement to those who think that they're not good at TPRS, it's a skill that needs a lot of practice. So, you know, don't worry about being one of those teachers that the students reported that they had negative experience with TPRS. If you're trying to do TPRS, keep trying, keep working. I mean, it's kind of improv. So, like, it just takes some time to get used to accepting answers and using actors and whatnot. So just keep with it. Even if students have had bad experience with TPRS, you can work to make sure that it's a better experience for them.
Yeah, and also it talks about how sometimes teachers feel that you need a certain type of personality to be successful at using TPRS, and, like, you have to be very extroverted and, like, you know, an actor or something like that. But it said that the teacher in the study didn't have, you know, she wasn't very super energetic, but she was able to weave in her own personality into the lessons, and students still found it effective. So if you're on the more introverted side, please don't feel like you can't do this, because there are lots of ways to do it and to keep it engaging without feeling like you need to have your energy levels at 150% all the time.
Because that is exhausting and you will burn yourself out.
I think it all just boils down to asking good questions. Like, you're asking good questions that provoke novel responses from your students, and then you're asking questions to ensure comprehension. And, you know, I'm an exuberant, goofy person, and I can do that in my way. And somebody who is not as exuberant and goofy can also just ask really good questions. It's fundamental to being a teacher in general, and then being a language teacher, a communicative language teacher in specific, is that we're communicating, we're having real communication.
Yeah, I think it's not about being high energy. It's about showing interest. Like, if you show interest in what you're talking about, then students are going to probably be bored as well. So even if I'm the same in the classroom, I can have a really, really big personality in the classroom and can react largely to student suggestions, but you could also react with just genuine interest. Like, oh, he has 3 eyes instead of 2 eyes. And it doesn't have to be like, tres ojos, no me digas. Like, you don't have to turn it all the way up to 11 to make it interesting and make it work.
Well, I think that's the study talks about too, is that what makes it thrilling is the not knowing what's coming next. And so, like, you don't need to you can put on a little show if you like to. I like to, because I am just a theatrical person. But the little show that's getting put on, again, is coming from the student responses to the structured activity. It's like the activity has a structure, it has a, you know, goal and purposes and, you know, rules to it and the way that it works. And so let the activity be the framework inside which the fun happens. You don't have to, you know, put window dressing on it too much, I think.
Yeah. And I think you can also lean into the fact that, you know, once you have a story and you've created a text related to it, you can then use that for lots of different comprehension-based activities. You can create a parallel text that is similar in structure, but it's got different details. So you can, I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone, but personally, I cannot do a TPRS story every single day, so I will do them and then have follow-up activities that are related and maybe require a little less energy on my part. And then when I'm feeling raring to go, once again, we will dive back in and do something else. But yeah, just don't feel intimidated by it.
All right, Ben. Do you want to take us home now with some girl bossing and co-creation of content?
Absolutely. I hope that people try this. I think, like I said earlier, it can be intimidating because you're not sure how each class is going to respond. You might know that a class is wiggly, and so you're worried about them getting out of hand, and so you want to limit the extraneous fun so that everyone doesn't get overstimulated. But I think it can be a really unifying experience, and with practice can be something that is super powerful for your students' language acquisition, but also they're building social bonds, exactly like the study says, you know, building that relatedness while also building competence in the language and giving them choice, autonomy. So I would say we've kind of touched on it in various ways before, but having a clear vision of what it looks like and what exactly are the parameters of how you want students to respond to questions, how you want them to respond to the story. And this can come from a few things. It's just having your own vision of, like, when I put my hand up, you put your hand up to respond. When I, you know, wave my arms towards myself, you get a shout out or response in any language. When I give a, you know, when I put 3 fingers up, that means I want you to wait 3 seconds to respond to the question. Because again, this is an exciting activity. Everyone's can get overstimulated very quickly. And we need to be able to manage how we're getting students to respond to the story. You might teach them rejoinders so that way they can just respond to the story with, you know, emotional responses as well. But if you're having a hard time of thinking like what the process of story asking can look like and how you should craft that vision, that I recommend watching people do it online. That is where I have watched other practitioners, kind of going back to our observation episode, is just like, I have watched other people doing it and I go, oh, that's how I can manage a story. That's how I can manage the responses and then build off of them and get tons of language out of them for my students. You know, modeling all sorts of different things has been by observing other people doing this. And there are tons actually of demos of people story asking online. So seek those out if you're not sure what your vision is. Watch somebody do card talk. Watch somebody create a one-word image. Watch somebody have a weekend chat with their class. All of these things, there are videos of these things online and plenty of resources of people talking about how they structure those activities.
Yeah. One piece of advice that might work for you in your context, but what has definitely worked for me is that really able to rein in kind of the chaos and also seeking input for the quieter students by structuring my, like I do a lot of one-word images, so structuring the process of that through a Pear Deck. So students log in to Pear Deck, which is basically like a synced up presentation that's got questions that students can answer on their own devices, and then they show up on the screen and, you know, things like that. So basically, I tell them, unless you can say this in French, you have to like write it, you know, give your suggestions in the computer, and they all show up on the screen. And then I will read, often just translating them into French. And then if there's, you know, some kind of decision that needs to be made, it's not clear what people prefer, then I ask the, professeur de, teacher number two, to make the decisions. And that has helped a lot. And also not talking over each other and giving everyone a chance to be heard. And it's really cool to watch how at the end of the story, a student says, oh yeah, that little detail, that was mine. But nobody knew it because it was all anonymous.
And I've got a couple tips and tricks that I like to employ when possible as well that seem to go well. So like the first one, going off of, Ben had mentioned rejoinders in stories. And I have taken to, when I am preparing a story for story asking, I look for some of the target structures or just whatever might be repeated a lot and assign a rejoinder to that. So earlier this week, the story was someone was really excited to go to the zoo. And so every single time that I said excited, I had a student with the rejoinder huepa, which is like a little Puerto Rican phrase that's just like of elation. And so then I make it, so if one student says it, everyone has to say it. So this past week, students have gotten huepa, they've gotten cuidado, careful, be careful. In the past, they've gotten que lastima, what a shame. So like anytime that something kind of unfortunate happened in the story, they had to say que lastima. Pobrecito is another one of my favorites, poor little thing, or si es la vida. Like those ones work well with the repetitive nature of stories, of story asking anyway, where the classic story asking, you do like the three different scenes or locations where essentially the plot just repeats, but it's in a new place. And also if a student has huepa, but they don't say it with the correct emotion, then I get an opportunity to just repeat myself until they respond with the reaction that I'm hoping that they do. Another little tip that I've seen, I haven't actually done this, but I should, is to have a Google form or even just a class discussion where you come up with a list of interesting places, a list of interesting people, interesting objects, and then you already have the list ready to go. If you really wanted to, you could have them on those big sticky notes around the room. And so you always have them available and you can add to them whenever. Something else that I've been working on, but I'm not very good at yet, is triangling, which is from TPRS 2.0, where essentially you ask the actor a question in second person and you give them the support to respond in first person, so that all students are hearing third, second, and first person forms of verbs while you're doing story asking, which you can also do with a parallel character. Sometimes I'll be the parallel character, like, oh, so-and-so is excited to go to the zoo. Am I excited to go to the zoo, or am I excited to go to a new restaurant? Something like that. So there's so many tips and tricks for story asking to help make it successful.
Yeah, something you said reminded me of that too. Provide fewer choices when you're co-creating content with students, because if we're thinking about cognitive load, perhaps opening the entire door could lead students to just spiraling off into thinking about the vastness of the universe, when sometimes maybe they just need a couple choices. And I think that happens for co-created content that isn't necessarily stories as well. Sometimes when we're asking students about something they did over the weekend, and we want to build out more of a sentence, more of a description about what their weekend looked like, we might ask the question, did you do that with? And that can be very overwhelming. You know, again, being forced to respond in English over and over again can maybe feel a little demotivating to a student. And so like Who did you go to the movies with, your friends or with your family? Might be another way to kind of keep the focus and build out the details without overwhelming the student by giving them think about everything they've ever thought ever in the universe. And so that, like, if you are creating a character, if you're creating a story, limiting the choices to start, like, are we talking about a piece of food or are we talking about an animal? And then they just have to choose from that, like moving through categories. I mean, you can support those with visuals on your board or just translations, whatever works, to keep it in the language. And then also, again, you know, keep the plot as it were, because it's easy to go to crazy town. Like, very, I would say too, that I'm thinking about how sometimes these, you know, these co-created activities, because you're asking for student input, generate a lot of new language, like we alluded to earlier. I think an idea I saw that was just like, if you get a new term, you just have to like slam it with repetitions pretty quick for like a couple questions in a row to kind of really hit that new word in different contexts. And maybe it's just simple circling questions with the word, or maybe it's, you know, sort of expansion questions. But if you get a new interesting word or term or phrase, just making sure you build in lots of repetitions by asking questions around that word.
Yeah. And just with that idea of limiting choices, that is another reason why I love Pear Deck, because you can do like multiple choice, like, how is the character feeling today? I have a list of 4 emotions. Choose one of them. Or like when I ask them, like, where are they going? I have a list of all the French-speaking countries. And it's like, they're going to a French-speaking country, but you get to choose which one it is. So yeah, they don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about it, but also they do get choice in it. I just find that helpful.
I think that would be pretty helpful too. That's going to be something that I might try to do. And maybe after we establish some people, places, and things, you know, the nouns, then that would make it a lot easier for me to go in to a story asking session with options, I think would be helpful. And then one last thing that I thought about was about like that, you know, parking on words and using them in context when a student asks for asks for you to establish meaning on something, then to park on it and make sure to use it so that, I mean, if we're going to throw this in the story, I don't want it to just be a throwaway word. I want to like use it a little bit, at least kickstart some acquisition on it. Maybe you don't see it for a really long time, but hopefully we can get a lot of robust exposure to it in the lesson. So, and that's something that's especially been helpful for level 4, because I think in general, when you're doing story asking, it's probably more simplified language than like the other content of a unit per se, maybe. At least the way that I look at it, it is kind of a way to just like start building vocabulary. So I really want my targeted vocabulary to be the only new stuff. But if other new language comes up, I'm going to try to park on it and personalize it. So if Abesrus does come up, like, oh, have you seen an Abesrus at the zoo? Has anyone seen an ostrich in person? Has anyone ridden an ostrich?
And again, the payoff, as Brian laid out in the article, is that when we give students these choices, when we do activities where there's creation involved, it can lead to greater feelings of autonomy, greater feelings of competence in the language, and greater feelings of relatedness. And so that is very motivating, and we want nothing more than to motivate our students to continue studying and learning the language. So hopefully you found something in this episode that motivates you to try some co-created content, despite any intimidation, while still also being able to bring culture and other people, you know, other real people in real situations from the world out into your classes. It is a balance of both, I would say. So we thank you for taking a listen to this conversation about co-created content. We are always welcoming of emails if you have any suggestions for podcast topics. If you have any questions about things that we have said, or if you just want to say hello, shoot us an email at our email address, which Bill is going to say right now.
Our email address is slayyy4everyone@gmail.com.
And those are all words. Is it for the number or the letter? Or the words?
Yeah, they're all words.
Okay.
F-O-R. SlayyyForEverone. BERYONE. gmail.com.
Yes, you did.
That's
yes, you did.
gmail.com.
So we thank you again for listening.
Slay.
Bye.